Welcome to Blind Spot Radio. This is Dave LaSpina.
And I'm Dave Bush.
Blind Spot Radio focuses on discussions with people in the photography field, photographers, curators, writers, critics, and innovators in technology.
A reason we thought this show would be great in the Hudson Valley is because there's so much going on here. We have several colleges with strong photography programs, local photography galleries, exhibitions, and organizations. We are today interviewing two of our good friends that also happen to be photographers.
Michael Varenwald, and Drew Donovan's going to call him later from New York. Michael's going to tell us what he's up to, and Drew has a new book coming out called Lifting Water, released by These Birds Walk, and it just came out this fall.
Feel free to call in at 518-828-0290 to get in line to ask us some questions, or if you have a question for Michael. Or Michael is here with us in the studio. So,
hi, Michael.
Say hello, Michael.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good.
All right. Well, we'll be right back.
Blind Spot Radio.
All right, you're listening to Blind Spot Radio on WGXC 90.7. I'm Dave LaSpina. Dave Bush and I are in the studio with photographer Michael Varenwald, living in Brooklyn, but originally from Iowa. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's correct. So, Michael, you were telling me before you came up here there's some shows that you saw recently. You saw all three of our former professor John Pilson's show at Nicole Klagsburn. What was going on there?
Wow, it was. Let's see here. It's what was going on there? It's a really good show. It's it's a viewing room of five different, I guess you call them, short films or videos, all completely separate subject matter. Maybe two bodies of photographs. And a sort of, I think it's about a 7-channel. I could be totally wrong here.
I think it's a 9-channel.
Is it 9-channel?
That he did for MoMA.
Yeah. And it's sort of a, I think it was miniaturized a bit and put on one end of the gallery. But it's a real tour de force, I have to say. Kind of amazing in a lot of respects.
What were the photographs?
Well, I believe they were from one of the period rooms at the Brooklyn Museum, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
A Frank Lloyd Wright room.
Yeah.
But there's all these sort of strange little production elements going on. People reading. There was a film made there. Was there?
Dave?
I'm not sure, actually. I haven't seen the show yet. So I do know about a piece that he did. Did you see the motorcycle piece?
Yeah, the Marnie engine.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
That was
he sent that to me before.
Was that a Daniel Benson?
It was a Daniel Benson, yes. The piece is from
here?
The perspective of as if you were driving a motorcycle, and what he does in the beginning is he's kind of duct taping this thing, and you don't know what it is, and then you realize it's like an iPad, and he's duct taping it to the motorcycle, and then he takes the motorcycle out, and it's shot from like one of those hero cams, you know, like a helmet cam, and he's driving around where I don't even really know where, but you know, it doesn't matter. And there's this kind of landscape going on, and you can see the iPad in this landscape, and the iPad is playing a scene from Marnie, is that right? Yeah, which, for those who don't know, is an Alfred Hitchcock film starring Sean Connery and...
Oh, what's her name?
What's her name?
Just look it up on your iPhone.
Yeah, right. It's a pretty interesting video. I mean, it's fascinating to kind of watch this landscape go by, and it's a scene from Marnie where she's kind of looking around for something. She's like in this room and she's kind of walking around and looking around. There's kind of like a reflection from the iPad, from the kind of there's kind of a reflection from the iPad that plays in. So it's this kind of visual interplay between reflection and video, and then like reality. And
it's also like it's like amazingly saturated with like things to look at, because it's sort of aggressively driven motorcycle with this sort of psychologically thrilling movie,
right?
And like this, the reflection action where you actually look back at the person driving the motorcycle and parts of it. It's just really. Yeah.
It's also a play on like so many of those YouTube videos we see, like the hero cam, some guy like skiing over a ledge or whatever, you know, with a parachute. And anyway,
very cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty
and then let's talk about our Bard Yale friend, Danny Gordon. Daniel Gordon has a new show
at
his
Wallspace.
New gallery, Wallspace. This is also going. Some of this work is going to be featured in the next Blind Spot issue. Curated by Tim Davis. Dave, can you tell us a little bit about what Daniel Gordon's work is like? He's been working.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's really evolved over the years, and you know, a lot of the work he deals with collage, and he does. You know, he uses photographs to kind of sculpt things and scenes or things that from his imagination or whatever. Now, he used to make the photographs himself to kind of recreate objects, like a la Thomas
DeMond.
Thank you. But now he's using internet and like found imagery to create the scenes that he's, you know.
Well, he prints out items that he finds on the internet.
Right.
And then he uses those, makes sculptures out of those items.
Right.
So it's not like Thomas DeMond is trying to be seamless.
No, yeah, of course. I'm just saying like in that style.
In that style. But it has a lot to do with our life and culture these days.
Absolutely. It's a little more relevant, I suppose. Yeah.
Sort of anti-seamless.
Right.
Anti-seamless.
Yeah, that's true.
But there were little moments. Yeah. And, you know, there'd be like a crudely rendered face,
right.
But the silhouette, right. The shadow it leaves on the wall is like a smooth profile of a person. Like
right.
there's little moments that are just kind of incredible. They're real sculptures.
Yeah. They are. They do function as sculptures.
The new ones look like Picasso's. They look like they're from,
yeah, they're beautiful.
They look like they're from the 20s.
They're so beautiful.
Very gorgeous.
Yeah.
Please bear with us while we have the Hudson Fire Department passing by our window, but I guess, you know, pointing it out makes it worse. Michael, you also saw two shows that sort of relate to each other. There's a Andreas Gursky show and a Edward Bertinsky show that are both aerial photographs but at different altitudes. Can you tell us about those?
Well, I could tell you my impressions
tell
of
us
them.
Your,
well, the Gursky show, right? It's at
his gallery.
Whatever his gallery is, Gagosian.
Yeah, Gagosian, okay.
Which is, I guess, new for him. I don't know. Where are they from? They're from. They're bodies of water photographed from above. But I don't know if I'd call the first. It's two galleries. It's a huge show. But I don't know if I'd call the first group aerials or not. Because they seem rather. They're sort of that ambiguous perspective that only Andreas Gursky uses, where there's really no distance in the picture, but the scale of it is so immense. But I thought they were really quite beautiful, these kind of small swaths of water with trash floating in them, just sort of content coming out of nowhere.
And the Gurskys are satellite photos, and one of his is of each major body of water, each ocean.
Oh, there was that one. Yeah, that was... So there's two sections. There's one that's sort of these smaller scale, not in print-wise, but these sort of closer views of just like this body of water.
Yeah.
And then the next gallery has these... like the ultimate objectivist photography of like the entire seven seas the entire continent of Antarctica.
And Antarctica.
It's like, he took it as far as it could go.
Do you think he's using... Photo merge in Photoshop for those?
That is the geekiest question I've ever heard.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I'm sure. Yeah, somewhere.
Just like click
totally.
Use open documents.
He's probably using some real technology there.
Yeah.
Dave.
CS 5.5.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, he might be privy to some new stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know about. You know, it's really funny, though, is at the same time, if you walked a few blocks over, you'd see the Edward Bertinsky Dryland Farming Show.
Yeah.
Which was a series of aerial photos of farmlands in the northern Spain. I guess it's sort of a rocky, arid area. I wouldn't necessarily call it desert. It's more like red soil.
Huh.
They're pretty interesting, but I noticed in the contrast, it kind of makes, I don't know. It shows differences in two photographers that I thought were rather similar. And it makes Gursky's work seem really poetic.
Really? Wow.
And so, but just for context, what is Bertinsky usually photographed?
Right.
What has he photographed in his past?
Is like a test?
No. Just context for the listener. Mostly, both of them are monumental photographers.
I want to see Bertinsky. It's more of almost like an activist photographer, photographing sort of environmental catastrophes and landfills and landfills made of tires copper runoff and things like that.
And the men taking apart giant ships in India.
Shipbreaking. Yeah. Those are wonderful. No, and Gursky's maybe more...
Uber?
I would almost say more philosophical in a sense.
Yeah.
Like it's definitely one step removed from the thing itself.
Right.
It's like the essence of the thing itself.
Well, it's almost like the hyper-reality of the thing itself, or the... It's all about the details of the kind of structure and the people and the scale and et cetera.
Indeed.
Right. So... I guess
what's this Sugimoto show?
Yeah.
Quickly.
Oh, wow. What was that called? It was called... I forget what it's called.
There's sculptures of some kind? Or?
Oh, it's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. I mean, he's got a photo show uptown, which I didn't see. But the show downtown, meaning Chelsea, it's like a series of crystal sculptures he had made. And they're all about... 5 inches tall, and they're a sphere with a little triangle on top and a little pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
And inside each sphere is a miniature Sugimoto seascape photo.
In a crystal ball.
Oh, wow.
In a little piece of crystal.
What
it is absolutely probably the most crazy show I've seen in a really long
show,
what's
time.
The point of doing, like, why has he done this whole elaborate thing with photographs that he already displayed, like, on their own, like, the seascapes are on their own as a...
I have no idea.
No, okay. He's made sculptures before.
No, I know.
And one of them one of them's featured on the Art 21 series.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that one.
It's like but that's like a full-scale sculpture. These are sort of minimalist. The show's called Surface of the Third Order.
Yes.
Wow.
That explains everything.
Yeah. It's kind of a pick and mix, if you will. Yeah. There's some cast aluminum mathematical models in one room. A little ode to Marcel Duchamp in another.
And if you're dying to see this, because we're not having a very good time describing it, it's up until December 23rd.
I highly recommend it.
Highly recommended. All right, so we're going to take a little break. Enough gallery talk for the time being. We've had Michael curate some music for us. I hate that word. Michael's picked some music for us. And what's coming up, Michael?
This is a song called... Mole in the Ground by Bascom Lamar Lumsford.
All right. Well, coming at you from 90.7 WGXC for Columbia and Greene Counties, Hands On Radio. I'm Dave LaSpina, Dave Bush, and we'll be back with more with Michael Verenwald.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground. Well, Tempe wants a $9 show. Yes, Tempe wants a $9 show. When I come over the hill with a $40 bill, tis, baby, where you been so long? I've been in the bin so long. Yes, I've been in the bin so long. I've been in the bin with the rough and rowdy men, 'tis, baby, where you been so long? Oh, I don't like a railroad man. No, I don't like a railroad man.
Welcome back. This is Blind Spot Radio. I'm Dave Bush.
And I'm David LaSpina.
We are talking with our good friend Michael Vernwald. We just listened to Mole in the Ground by, who was that, Michael?
Bascom Lamar Lumsford.
I'm glad I didn't have to say that.
It's from the Smithsonian Anthology.
Oh, cool.
Very cool.
Oh, yeah.
That anthology is great. It has a great booklet, if I remember right. No?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you bought the book. You bought the whole CD. Retail.
I indeed did.
Yes. Purchased it legally.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. Oh, of course.
No, you know, actually, I downloaded it because I lost the CD.
Okay.
Oh.
Legally downloaded it.
Legally.
Right. I paid for it.
Yeah. Twice. Okay.
John Cohen actually had a lot to do with that music coming out.
Hmm. Huh.
Or that genre of music.
Well, someone has to dig through the archives.
That's true.
Indeed.
So, Michael,
we're going to.
Speaking about digging through your archives. Well, no, it's not your archives. It's your new work. Can you tell us about what you're up to lately? Right now, I saw a show in White Plains, which involves some photographs of empty and repurposed banks. You call that series People's Trust?
Well, yeah, it's called The People's Trust.
The People's Trust.
Yeah, it was actually started as a somewhat of a commission, if you will. Arts Westchester asked me if I would do a piece they did a show about banking. And we kind of kicked around a lot of ideas, and sort of at the last minute, I was down in the Wall Street area, and I noticed the first ever Jewish bank in New York was a Chinese takeout place at this point in time. And I remember from college days it being a video game parlor before, and I thought, wow, there must be a lot of these things. So sort of this circuitous path it took me on. I started in Wall Street looking for, I guess, abandoned or repurposed bank buildings.
Yeah.
Here's a picture of that.
Was that video game parlor the same one that was in Tron?
I don't know how to answer that.
So
just ignore him.
I don't know what to say.
Right. So Michael, you've brought some photographs.
Yeah.
I'm gonna hold it up to the microphone.
Yeah, maybe that's the problem with the photo radio show.
Right.
Anyway,
describe these pictures, how you photograph these banks.
Well, in a sense, it's maybe the most indexically flat photo project I've done so far. And it began just looking for these sort of previous financial institutions and photographing them in these sort of deadpan ways. And it's one of those projects where, I don't know, I sometimes like to think of photography as a game. And once the game is started, you start seeing little participants everywhere, little parts of the game everywhere. And it's taken me from Wall Street, and for the first time I showed them, I went from Wall Street through Brooklyn, through the Bronx, and into like White Plains, Westchester area, photographing these repurposed, reclaimed banks. And I don't know if you've seen, there's a graph that's been kind of passed around on Facebook and whatnot. It's sort of like the history of the banking industry in the U.S. and in the world.
I have not seen that.
Well, it starts out with maybe 100 players in the game. And it's a timeline, but it's also sort of like almost like a brackets from a sports betting arena. And it whittles itself down to about 5 major banks. And weirdly, what a lot of my pictures end up being are these sort of what used to be banks or banks from certain neighborhoods. So when Brooklyn used to be a system of wards, each ward had its own bank, like a community bank, things like that. So it's this kind of odd history written in architecture and literally written on the sides of these buildings. You'll see signs like the People's Trust or the Mechanics Trust and Savings Bank.
And you have here the first National City Bank, which became Citibank, and it's turned into a Payless shoe store.
Yeah, a lot of them have this really delicious irony going on.
Delicious as in this one that was turned into a McDonald's? Or
The Lincoln Savings Bank turned into a McDonald's and an orthodontist office.
Ooh. So like a McGriddle, and then you can go to the orthodontist or the dentist and get your teeth cleaned.
Right. Yes, and the Manufacturer's Trust Building, which was turned into a Fat Albert warehouse.
Wow.
Right. And so you can see all these photographs on michaelvarenwald.com.
That's right.
And they're well worth the trip.
Yeah. And there's links to this on blindspot.com/radio if you want to follow along at home.
Yeah.
So I'm noticing some of these are in black and white. Why? And some of them are in color. Why have both? I'm just curious.
Why have both?
The thought process. Or is it just like a technical thing?
You know, it's a body of work that one picture tends to run off another. And to kind of keep this, like if you see one, it's a picture of an abandoned building. But when you see two, something starts happening. When you see three, it starts unfolding more and more. Right. And to kind of keep a greater unity for the whole series, sometimes color-wise, a few of these places would just jump out like sore thumbs, or they'd been repurposed into nightclubs with,
neon
purple awnings and neon whatever.
Right.
And to kind of keep it a little more Bescher-esque. I definitely toned them down a bit. So the black and white is almost out of necessity.
Huh.
But yeah, right now we're standing at about 30 images of these places. I went to Chicago. I went kind of around rural Illinois and rural Iowa so far. And I have a bunch of other trips planned out. Actually, I'm up here. I was photographing in Ossining today.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, that was part of it.
Wow.
Anything north of New York City is up here?
Up here. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
That's all right. We're out here.
South Rochester.
Well, talking about making the city into something else, I saw some still lives that you made on streets of New York, I assume?
That's true, yeah. There's this body of work I've been working on. So, I don't know, these things kind of come in pairs. In which I've been doing projects that are very literal and projects that are very poetic. So, I've been photographing basically sort of industrial areas in and around Maspeth and Bushwick and the sort of industrial areas of New York City. And a lot of them are just sort of these weeds growing out of the cracks of sidewalks, a la a little bit of Walt Whitman and whatnot. They're sort of unintentional still lives, but they're called the Forest Floor, and they're based on a Dutch painter named Otto Marcellus van Schaick, who sort of did these indexical pictures, these still lives of plants, weeds, animals, but maybe a little bit before natural history sort of started making everything quantifiable or selectable. So they sort of have this odd era where the weed growing out of the picture has the same value as a snake, has the same value as a corner of a building, and they're sort of oddly equivalent all around. And I was kind of thinking about this when I was going into, like, say, different parts of Greenpoint or different parts of Maspeth and photographing these sort of unintentional still lives. A lot of them are lit with a camera flash, and I brought in a little bit of blackout cloth to kind of clean them up.
Yeah, I was
going to
ask you about that. Yeah, because a lot of them we're looking at, they're all at night, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have very, you know, you can kind of see the ground and maybe a little bit of fencing and a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, but mostly it's like a black background, almost like a studio. And I'm wondering if, well, I guess you just answered that question, but I think I'm wondering how much control you have, I guess, as you're making these.
It's definitely a constant fight.
Because
I think part of it is that, if you saw it from the outside, it just looks absolutely ridiculous. It's like me, sometimes I can convince a friend to come with a roll of gaffer's tape, a sheet of black velvet, and couple lights on stands, photographing a hunk of garbage and a weed growing out of the sidewalk.
They're haunting. They're beautiful.
It's kind of embarrassing to make.
Sounds like a fun evening.
Anyone out there is interested in a fun evening with Michael Varenwald photographing weeds. Yeah. So it's a fight because it's as if it's studio photography, but you're still dealing with wind and nature and traffic.
But I think that's potentially an amazing combination. of things to be able to control. And really, what you're doing is kind of isolating these things, which is, you know, and you're taking them out, almost taking them out of context. There's a hint of context to a lot of them, which I think is actually brilliant. They're beautiful. They're really beautiful.
And then you have another body of work that is similar. I mean, you've separated these two bodies of work into, there's one that's the forest floor and there's another that's methods and receiver.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and one is in color and one's in black and white. So the forest floor is in color?
Yeah, the forest floor is in color. The prints are a bit larger. They tend to be 24 by 30 inch prints. There's a couple that are larger right now. And then the methods and receiver work, you know, it's kind of like one of those quick bodies of work. I was doing a residency at the Vermont Studio Center and really didn't know what to do out there. I kind of just wanted some time to think.
Yeah, it's pretty isolated out there.
It's pretty isolated. Yeah. But I ended up, they give you little jobs out there, or if you ask for them, and my job was weeding the gardens. And I started thinking about what I was doing and thinking how interesting these weeds were. And I was also reading that book, The Secret Life of Plants, at the time.
Oh, that's a great book.
Yeah. So there's this scientist, L. George Lawrence, who basically proposed that plants talk to outer space, talk to Ursa Major. And it and I guess that's what you do when you're out in Vermont, read books like that. but it dawned on me that, this is this idea of classifying things into weeds and, you know, classifying plants as useful and what practice. But then it also dawned on me that just looking at any sort of thing in the middle of the night when you're not supposed to be looking at it automatically makes it strange. So I started going out into the gardens, started not weeding and telling them I did, and going out into the gardens in the middle of the night with these wonderful weeds and actually lighting them with an infrared flash and shooting them with the infrared film, so they kind of have this glowy sort of otherworldly look to them. It's a real quick project, but it's produced some pretty dramatic and interesting looking results that I've been really happy with.
Now, are you classifying the weeds at all? Are you trying to like find out what kind of weeds, like what kind of plants they are, and or is that important at all? Is it just visual?
You know, it's important to me in terms of the titling of them. But like, if you put me on the spot and ask me about one
now.
I may not know.
I'm not going to do that. I'm just curious about that aspect of it.
Yeah, somewhat. I do find that important. I tend to find the balance between like absolute specificity and ambiguity in my work to be really important. So in the actual titling of all these, it's the plant itself, the sort of scientific name of the plant.
I guess part of the reason I asked is because our other good friend Pete Monty did a series on weeds a while ago. It was a couple, like 10 years ago maybe at this point. I've only seen a few of them, but he was kind of obsessed with them. And they were more a kind of, there was more context to the pictures, and he was using a flash as well, but they were made more during the day, and the flash sort of just highlighted the one, you know, very, it could be something very delicate, you know, but it would be this kind of highlighted element of the picture that was, so it was they're totally different pictures, but the title of the photographs was the name of the weed that he was photographing.
Where can I see these?
I'm not sure, actually. I don't even know if they're online.
Friend of the show, Pete Monty.
Yes.
Well, I know where he works.
Yes.
I'll have to ask him about that. That's kind of amazing. Yeah. It's really...
I've only seen a few of them, but I know they exist.
Yeah, they're not the easiest thing to identify.
Yeah.
They're not all listed on the container of Roundup.
And there's not an Audubon book devoted to weeds?
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Indeed. I do actually have a sort of almanac of weeds that I kind of started from that I bought. Yeah, I'm sure Darwin probably did some weed studies as well.
It's interesting, too, because a lot of photographers and artists I know are big-time mushroomers, like go around finding mushrooms in places, and that's like another edible mushrooms that aren't the legal kind.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that artists kind of, I don't know, flock to these sorts of maybe outsider plants, as it were, maybe. Mushrooms, weeds. No?
No, no.
Is that a leap?
No, no, right. It's not a leap. So we're going to take a little break. Thank you, Michael, for talking about your new work. And remember, yes, you can visit at michaelvarenwald.com. V-A-H-R-E-N-W-A-L-D. Did I spell your name right?
Oh, you did.
Okay.
You spelled it right.
.com. So we're going to take a little music break. Dave, Michael, what do we have coming up next?
This is a song by Lucinda Williams called Lafayette. It's another one of my favorites.
All right, we'll be right back. This is Blind Spot Radio, 90.7 WGXC, hands-on radio serving Columbia and Greene counties.
Oh, my sweet Lafayette, how I'm gonna miss you. You feel so good, Lafayette. Now I've come to greet you. Hello, my friends, I've come back again. I couldn't stay away. I was gone only a day, but I'm coming back. Until three, and I gotta get back to my sweet Lafayette.
All right, welcome back to Blind Spot Radio. I'm Dave LaSpina.
I'm Dave Bush.
And we're here with Michael Varenwald having a round table of discussion about photography. That was just Lucinda Williams. I can't say her name.
Lucinda?
Lucinda Williams. Lucinda Williams.
And the song was called Lafayette.
Lafayette. So coming up next is my favorite segment. It's Guess That Camera.
So,
yes, Dave.
My mic is blowing out. Each show, we have a camera in the studio. This is our game. This is our quiz game. And what we do is David LaSpina will press the shutter button of the camera
and release the sound into the microphone.
Into the microphone.
And so you can email us.
It'll be your job to guess that camera.
Yes, you can email us at Dave's. plural@blindspot.com, or you can send a tweet to @blindspotmag and have your best guess. The prize is the most recent issue of Blindspot magazine, either the current issue or the next one coming out, which you can pick up at WGXC Studios. So I'm going to lower the music here, and we're going to take a second to squeeze the shutter. So hold on.
Sounds like a typewriter.
Ooh, typewriter. Ooh.
No.
Let's do that again.
Okay, ready?
Sounds like a penguin.
Can you like a singular?
Singular one? Shot, yeah.
That kind of gives it a hint.
So I'm going to turn this down to from 8 frames a second to 1 frame a second. Okay.
All right.
So the phone did ring. I don't know who this is. But, or did they hang up?
Oh, they might have hung up.
No, there's someone on the line. Oh. Hold on a second. Let me Dave, can you get the Girls on Film going again?
Oh, sure.
All right. Okay, false alarm.
False alarm.
Okay. But so, email your guesses into daves@blindspot.com. And let's just wait a second and let's segue to our next segment, which is a little bit of tech talk. There's some interesting news coming out from Canon and Nikon after some flooding in Thailand caused some delays for distribution and the earthquake in Japan. Those are moot issues considering the travesty that partook, that it delayed a camera coming out. But nonetheless, some interesting technology. So, Dave, you're going to tell us first about the Canon Mark IV.
Well, yes. First, I'd like to mention, and we're going to be devoting a show to this, but they are making Deerdorfs again.
Oh, yeah.
People.
That's some low.
That's huge news for me because I was a large format photographer for many years and still am. And someone bought all of the factory molds and tools and stuff like that and has devoted a website to it now. And so they are literally making new ones. And we'll have more on that later. But they're making a 4x5, an 8x10, an 11x14, and a 12x20, allegedly.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I was a sucker for the banquet
format. It'll have kind of different plating on it, but essentially the designs are the original blueprints.
Are they going to service old ones?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's really good.
They're going to have parts and everything. They already have parts. They have like thousands of parts that are left over from the factory. But anyway, more on that later. That was just a news bulletin.
Breaking news.
Breaking news. Well, not really. So, looking at the website canonrumors.com. Oh, hold on. So, looking at the website canonrumors.com, the 5D Mark III, because the 5D Mark II has been out for about 2 years now, and people are starting to wonder when the next generation is coming out.
It's so old.
Right. I mean, in terms of the digital age, it's ancient.
Boring.
But so they're not sure what they're going to call it. It could be the 5D Mark III. It could be the 6D. But it's going to be out supposedly next year at some point. They're still working on it. And some of the things that are going to change, it's going to be a... It's going to be...
Dave.
It's going to have a 24-megapixel sensor, which is a full frame. It's going to have a faster processing engine, which will allow you to shoot at that extremely fast speed of 8 frames per second that David was just shooting at. And that's not the answer to guess that camera, by the way. It will have higher ISOs because the Mark II goes to 6400, and people are complaining about that because compared to the Nikon, it's really not that high. It will have more autofocus points. It will have, and I like this, we'll have a built-in level on
the
camera.
I've seen those. That's good.
So for the view camera photographer in all of us, that will be like a nice thing to have.
Are they going to send Blind Spot Radio a demo?
Well, I'm hope I've written them a letter, so I hope that will, because we're we're like heavy hitters over here. So the other thing it's going to have is an in-camera rating system, which will allow you to chimp your pictures even more in a more sophisticated manner.
For the benefit of the rest of us, could you explain chimping a picture, Dave?
That means you look at the picture after you take it, essentially the preview. So you kind of end up looking like a chimp as you do.
So just like a monkey keeps on looking at what he eats over and over again.
Exactly.
Is that true?
But you'll be able to rate. You'll be doing like in-camera editing to a whole new level. So
yeah. Huh.
Anyway, that's the list. That's the news from
that's
Canon.
The list. And I have a quick thing to mention about the new Nikon D800, which is sort of secretly announced.
Right.
It's going to be full frame, 36 megapixels, and 1080p HD. So a new camera from Nikon after 2 years for The Professional.
Right.
Good for chimping.
Good for chimping. So chimping approved. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and we have Drew Donovan on the line to talk about her new book, Lifting Water. We'll be right back after this musical break. Welcome back to Blind Spot Radio. Dave, what were we just listening to?
We were listening to Michael Rowling.
Oh, that was Rolling Sea by Vetiver.
Vetiver. Okay.
Good jam.
Good song.
Good song. All right. Well, coming. We have our friend Drew Donovan on the line from New York City. Drew, can you hear us?
Yeah. Hi, guys.
Hey, Drew. It sounds... I don't know if it sounds too distorted for our fans out there, all four of you, but we wanted to talk to you about your new book called Lifting Water,
which is beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
Do you know Michael, Drew?
I don't. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Drew.
Nice to meet you via many modes of communication.
Right.
Yeah. Nice that you're in my headphones.
Right.
Oh, nice.
So, Drew, Dave took some time to write down some questions to ask you about your new book. But first, would you like to describe it briefly?
Yeah. The book is part of TBW Books subscription series 3. And TBW Books is a publisher out of Oakland, California. Paul Sheik is the publisher. And he puts out a series of 4 books, and each book is made by a different photographer, and so I'm honored to be a part of this series. And the other 3 photographers are Mark Steinmetz, Elaine Stotsky, and Katie Grannon. And so the books are all constructed in the same manner. We all had 20 pages to sort of to make whatever... images and sequence we wanted. We worked with Paul in different ways to edit the work, but I decided to, my book is focused on, it was made after I was, it was made after I was with my friend while he was diagnosed with cancer and then through when he was passing away. And so I was involved sort of throughout that whole period, and specifically this book focuses on the caretaking part, sort of the helping during that time that was going on. And so I didn't make any images really during that time, and so I decided to I wanted to figure out a way to sort of deal with it photographically, look at what happened in photographically. And so I hired different models to and cast them and had them reenact the gestures of caretaking that I really remembered and just photograph, had them sort of redo those gestures over and over and over again. I mean, almost in an obsessive way, and then just continued to document it and tried to figure out how to make pictures. So that's kind of the quick rundown of it. But it was definitely made, you know, I think there's a real, and I can sort of see this now being on the other side of it, but it was a book made after something happened, like while mourning, while you couldn't go back. Trying to figure out how, I mean, I think the way I explain it is that after that time, your life is, like, I was so disoriented what was going on. Nothing kind of made sense. My reality didn't anymore. And so a lot of people give you advice, like you should try exercise or therapy or religion or whatever and to cope. And I found that a lot, it's like I wanted to be able to cope in a way I already knew how to, and photography that existed before, and photography was one that was that for me. So it was really like trying to deal or solve a problem using photography.
It's almost like photography as catharsis in a way, or?
Yeah, very much catharsis. So, and, you know, never with the intention of trying to, like, actually make it believable or actually cast people that looked like who were there, or it was just more everything had physically just changed. Everything changed so fast, too. It all happened, and it was really, I mean, maybe I'm just really visual, but it was just seeing, like, okay, what is it like? You know, it was a good one that started. There were things that I didn't know how to do. I didn't know how to help someone out of bed who couldn't hold themselves anymore. I didn't know. I hadn't been around the process of dying. And so in a very quick period, I learned that, and it was a weird thing to start to know, to start to feel familiar. So it was trying to figure out how to revisit that.
Right. So most of the pictures are sort of details of gestures or sort of little scenes that you remember seeing, and there's an interesting picture in there where there's a photograph of you taking a picture.
Yeah. The whole project actually only took place over 3 different days. It was like it ended up being actually not planned, but every Sunday for 3 weeks, and I would rent the same motel room, and for the last 2 weeks, a photographer, Joel Fisher, he photographed at the same time. Well, I asked him to document the whole thing and just sort of everything happening. It was kind of happening again so fast, I didn't really know what I was. I knew I wanted to see something, and I wanted to figure out how to make a picture. And so I just thought it would be interesting to sort of have the whole process documented as well. And so I put that image in. Kind of, I think, really as a gesture to show the set of it all, but it was constructed and sort of show me as a participant in it, even like in the reconstruction and in the actual event.
Well, I guess, you know, my first question, knowing you as I do and knowing your work, is, you know, a lot of people would go through that experience that you went through that was like a real life experience that inspired you to make these pictures. Most photographers I know would go through that and either want to take pictures during that to kind of deal with it, or they would kind of go out and into the world and find that sort of thing happening and try to document it in a way. How do the reenactments, I guess, function for you? And, you know, why reenact something that seems to happen a lot, you know, this kind of thing that is, you know, people come to the end of their lives and they're assisted some way. Why reenact it, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And And that was also something like, I was thinking about a lot, as though, as like, it was an incredibly particular time in my life and a particular experience, but also one that I know is incredibly universal, and that will happen again in my own life, I'm assuming. So I think it was, I didn't document, you know, I couldn't make pictures at the time. I think intimacy was a big part of intimacy and vulnerability, and like just having someone help you, letting someone help you. And then also, he was a friend, he wasn't my sort of, I mean, I consider him and his family like family now, but you know, there was a lot of trust to be let in, and so that didn't, it just didn't seem, it just, there was like no instinct. It didn't. It wasn't appropriate, and then I didn't feel the need to go find someone else. And it was very particular. Like they were actual. Like I think it's also how I just approach photography.
Yeah.
I think I don't. I'm not interested. I don't think I've ever really come from. I think I've always been in love with people that work in maybe the observational mode of making the picture.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of observation that's sort of the foundation of my work, but I don't think. I think it's like how I build images, I would say. So it's, I think it was actually pretty in line with how I kind of already worked. And I think I was trying to show, like, if it didn't work, if it didn't, if some pictures, if something was believable at times and then fake at other times, I think it pointed to the fact that it, it couldn't, that it is a universal, like, I did understand how it was, like, like once you have that experience and you meet someone else that has that experience, it's almost like, I don't know, it's just sort of like, yeah, I understand, I get it, it's a different thing you have on you. And then so it just felt like also if it didn't, if the picture failed or if it didn't look totally believable, I think I felt like it pointed to the fact that it couldn't be, that you can't go back and you can't revisit photographically. So I don't know, that was just, it was something I needed to see.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, and if you believe that, you know, it's interesting because we're at this sort of crossroads in photography where the lines of fiction and reality are more and more blurred every day, it seems. And the style that you're working in, I don't know, kind of seems to address that in some, in a pretty direct way. I mean, you're definitely reenacting these things. And but at the same time, there's an element of chance, I think, to the pictures, I assume, when you see something. I mean, how heavily directed are they, I guess, is
it's completely, I mean, it's still like a bunch of people I met on Craigslist and asked to show up to a room, and I've never met them.
Right.
And what I found was that it was like, there's the reenactor, there's the directing, but I was also just trying, like, how do you make that picture? How do you show this? How do you describe this? And so even I found that it, within that one room and with these particular people, I would constantly be moving them around. Like, if the light changed and the light was better by one window, I had to move the bed over to the window. And I was like, we're going to work over here now. Or if it referenced a motel too much, I was like, let's just, like, I just had other, some models just hold, like, sheets up. So we could sort of use that as a backdrop and then work in front of that. It was more, it was a completely clumsy set. But there were moments, I mean, I think, and this was part of my, like, working way, like, how I've worked in the past, or something I've learned about, like, over time, is that something still has to be, it can't all be just invented for me. Like, something still has to happen. Like, you still have to ask. So when I gave them the direction of, like, okay, you two help him out of bed, lift him up, that's all I did. And they'd ask, how do you do it, or how do you want, where should we stand? I should figure it out. Just figure out how to, because I didn't know how to do it when I started.
Right.
And so, and then the other part was that the person who played the main sort of subject in the book, he had had an experience of taking care of his mother and his sister when they passed away, and so that I knew was key. I felt that was key to sort of making the set work, because he really did understand how the body shuts down, how the person goes inside of themselves, so like how heavy a body is when there isn't strength.
Well, Well, thank you, Drew, for talking with us. I think we're almost out of time.
No, thanks for having me, guys. All right,
thanks, Drew. And you're saying TBW Books stands for These Birds Walk, but the website is tbwbooks.com, and on the Blind Spot Radio page, we have links to Drew's work, which is drudonovan.com, and an interview that she had with Joel Wellington Fisher, she had him do some document work on the book as well. But thank you, Drew, and thank you for calling us. And
hope thanks to having me.
Thanks, Drew. Hope to see you soon. And this has been
Blind Spot Radio, and Dave's going to take us out with one more song. Is this another Michael Verenwald decision? Or, I mean, selection? All right. So what do we have here?
This is, appropriately, it is called Gone.
Gone.
By Morgan O'Kane.
And this is Blind Spot Radio on 90.7 WGXC, hands-on radio serving Greene and Columbia counties and reaching all the way out there to Great Barrington sometimes.
That's right.
And so have a good day. And
keep on making great photographs.
Talk to you soon. Bye.